From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the May 2025 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Dollis Hill Days. During World War II, Bletchley Park collaborated with several external engineering institutions in developing the famous code-breaking machines such as the Bombs and Colossus. One such institution was the Post Office Research Station at Dollis Hill in London. In 2022, the previously secret war diaries of the research station were released online to the public by BT, the successor to GPO Telecommunications. In this episode, we're joined by James Elder, an archivist from BT Group Archives, as well as our own research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, to find out what information the diaries can reveal about this secret collaboration. Many thanks to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing extracts from the war diary. We'll start with you, David, and a bit of background. What was the Post Office Research Station?
The Post Office Research Station is established in 1909, and it's a place for technological research for communications and other technologies required by the post office, essentially, because at this point they're not just posting letters, they're also doing telecommunications, so telephone, telegraph, those sorts of things. After World War One, it moved to the location we're concerned with, which is Dollis Hill in North London. Initially, they set up there in some army timber huts, but in the 20s and early 30s, the current building, the organisation isn't there anymore, but the building still is. It's a rather magnificent building, large structure on the top of Dollis Hill, which you can see for miles, which was opened in 1933 by Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald. And research carried on in there through the 1930s and into World War II. And it's the World War II phase that we're particularly interested in, because the GPO research station was doing technical research in all aspects of communications, including for GC&CS. There are various projects that they helped GC&CS with. Most famously of these is the Colossus machine, mm-hmm. which was built to help with key finding for Lorentz, which we've talked about before in this podcast.
And which we refer to as the world's first large-scale digital computer.
We do. But that's only one of a whole series of projects that were worked on by the GPO. They did a lot of work on bombs, which we will talk about, and other bits and pieces. So there's a variety of different aspects of GC&CS's work that were tied up with Dollis Hill. And of course, we've spoken in previous podcasts about how the GPO was also involved on site here at Bletchley, assisting with communications in and out and teleprinting and voice frequency telegraphy and all these other technical aspects of what Bletchley did. So the relationship between the GPO and GC&CS is pretty strong and constant throughout the war. The station has moved. It's not in Dollis Hill anymore. The original building is now luxury flats. I was privileged to go up there last year or the year before to unveil a plaque to Tommy Flowers, who, of course, famously worked on Colossus and was based at Dollis Hill. And we had a chance then to look around the building and take some photos. And it's quite swanky now. The organisation, the research station itself, moved to a site at the former RAF station at Martlesham Heath in Suffolk. That opened in 1975 as Adastral Park. And the organisation remains under BT today.
The war diaries, which we're talking about today, were written by Gordon Radley and obviously recently released. Tell us more about this man. Who was Gordon Radley?
Well, he's actually William Gordon Radley, WG, but he went by Gordon. He was born in Worcestershire and, like many people at the time, trained as an engineer. And in those days, you didn't go to university to do engineering. You typically went via an apprenticeship route, so you'd start quite young. He grew up in Leeds, trained as an engineer, and then joined the post office in 1920, when he would have been in his early 20s himself. So he worked at the post office, but was also able to continue his engineering education while he was there. And he actually did his PhD while working for the GPO. By 1939, by this time he's in his early 40s, he became director of the Post Office Research Station at mm-hmm. Dollis Hill. So he's the boss of that organisation. And part of his role is to keep this war diary of all the activities the organisation is doing. He does that through the war. After the war, he continued to rise through the ranks of post office engineering, becoming controller of engineering after the war, and then engineer in chief to the post office, at which point he became Sir William Gordon Radley. And ultimately, in 1955, he ended up as director general of the post office. So a distinguished career within post office communications and the post office as a whole. He died in 1970, and we specifically remember him here because alongside our auditorium in Block E, we have the Radley Room, which is our sort of breakout space there, function suite. And we named that in his honour to recognise the relationship between GCNCS and the GPO during the war.
And when we did a bit of research for exactly that, for naming that event space, the Radley Room, we actually found out it was quite hard to find out information about Gordon Radley. James, can you tell us a little bit more about Radley the man?
I think the first thing to say is that it's striking that he, as an engineer, got to the top of the organisation as Director General. And that's very unusual in the civil service and the post office at this point. The engineers tend to rise and their head of profession is being, you know, engineer in chief. I think I'm right in saying he was the first engineer to rise to become the head of the post office. The Director General was a sort of newish title at that point after a reorganisation in the 30s. And you have to remember that the post office is a vast organisation at this point. I think something like getting on for 250,000 staff. Around this time, it was alongside the NHS, the biggest public sector employer and indeed one of the biggest employers in the country. And it was generally headed by civil servants from a policy and an administrative background. So it's unusual for an engineer to get to the top like that. And I think that and other incidents in his career tell us that as well as being a very fine engineer, he was also clearly a very good manager. He seems to have excelled at sort of managing complex projects and large teams, and he successfully delivered on a number of those during the war and after. And so he's described in his obituary in the Times as having a friendly and sometimes enigmatic twinkle, and he did inspire a great deal of loyalty. And we're going to obviously talk about his wartime work, but it is worth stressing that under his leadership, the post office also did some extremely impressive things. The sort of biggest legacy, perhaps, is around global telecommunications. Dollis Hill, in the post-war period, developed what's known as a submarine repeater. Basically, this was something which could go on a submarine cable, a telephone cable, and boost the signal. So up until that point, it had not been feasible to have intercontinental telephone calls by cable. To do that, you needed a repeater, and for it to be an underwater repeater, it had to be something which could go without maintenance for 10, 20 years, just quietly doing its job. And they developed that, and then that allowed, with collaboration with the Canadian and US counterparts, the laying of TAP-1, the first transatlantic telephone cable in the late 50s. And it's that which, when Radley is awarded the Faraday Medal by the Institute of Electrical Engineers, it's particularly for that that he's recognised. Again, showing that he was good at, if you like, the administrative and political side. He, in that period, as Director General, managed to redefine the relationship between the Treasury and the Post Office, which had been troubled for getting on for a century, with the Treasury generally regarding the Post Office as something of a cash cow through its, because it was a trading organisation, they regarded it as the main thing, as generate income for the Treasury, which could make long-term planning and investment very difficult for the post office. There was legislation which changed that and eventually led, after Radley's retirement in 69, to the post office becoming a public corporation rather than the government department that it was. And ultimately, it sort of is what lays the ground for BT being hived off and then privatised. So he made a sort of huge difference, both in research terms and technological development terms and in administrative and economic terms, to the sort of telecommunications landscape we're in today.
Bringing us back to our focus of World War II, I'm interested in the relationship between the GPO research station at Dollis Hill and GCNCS at Bletchley Park. David, can you tell us a bit more about that close relationship and the co-working?
I can. And the one thing you have to remember about GCNCS, both before and during its time at Bletchley Park, is that we think of it as an organisation being incredibly innovative. And you have Alan Turing, Gordon Welshman, John Tiltman, Dilly Knox, all these people coming up with these incredible ideas. But some of the most famous ideas, for example, the bomb machines or the Colossus machines or any of the other machines, Dragons, whatever they are, GCNCS itself is a pencil and paper organisation. It's a group of Foreign Office civil servants in a room. But what they don't have is the ability to do engineering. They don't have an engineering department as such. So when GC&CS wants to build something, and we have evidence of this, when Dilly Knox sets up his workshop for gadgets in the bungalow, they're limited to kind of string, old toilet rolls, bits of cardboard.
It's really tinkering, isn't it? More than actually making things.
It's tinkering, developing little gadgets that are proof of concept, but they're not able to build a big machine. I mean, one of the things that is misleading about the Imitation Game film is you see Alan Turing in a building, physically building a bomb machine
himself, soldering bits with
a spanner and all of this. Yeah. GC&CS didn't do that. If they wanted a device, how it worked was the great brains, Turing and Welshman, would devise what the device was supposed to do, and then GC&CS had to go out and find an engineer who had the capability to turn that into a real thing. And Dollis Hill is another source of engineering expertise that GC&CS can turn to. And so GC&CS has to rely on these kind of organisations to get anything built. When I was working on my bomb project, I spent a lot of time looking at the official paperwork in the National Archives. And there's a lot of paperwork preserved in that archive from Gordon Welshman in particular. There are memos that run to many pages from Gordon Welshman about the development of the bombs and other technical projects. The problem from a historical point of view is you only see one side of the story.
So the Dollis Hill War Diary provides some balance, would you say?
It does. It provides the other side of the hill, the other half of the conversation. That can be really helpful.
Finding out more about this Dollis Hill War Diary, and I'm calling it diary singular, but there are two volumes, I understand. So if we say diaries, it's just the one, but it's in two parts. James, what is the Dollis Hill War Diary? How did it come about?
People are quite likely to be familiar with the concept of war diaries in the context of military units. That's something which, going back to the 19th century and in the UK to after the Boer War, the idea of units keeping contemporaneously recorded diary of engagements and things like that. In the Second World War, I'm not sure how much it went across Whitehall, but certainly within the post office, a number of units kept similar documents recorded by their head of unit at the time of events, recording their major activities. And we've got quite a few of them in the BT archives. Radley seems to have been given the brief of writing for Dollis Hill, for the Post Office Research Station, a brief but comprehensive account of all the special projects that they'd taken on. He starts with the outbreak of war, and I think the first entry is something to do with Dollis Hill being used as emergency accommodation for the Admiralty. Also, you know, covers things that are happening at the building as well. But he goes right through to sort of VJ Day, recording the special work that they have taken outside their normal activities. And so the diary runs to two sort of post office leather-bound binders of legal-sized paper in typescript, mostly in typescript. It doesn't get into any lengthy details of any project, although things like the work for GC&CS being a major one, you do get longer entries in that. But because Radley's an engineer, and so he understands, well, almost all of what's going on, even though he may not have the full technical expertise of some projects, but he has a good understanding of all the work. So it can sometimes get quite technical in nature, but it gives an overview of all the different projects that are going on.
I suppose if it's that kind of thorough, it makes sense that it was secret.
Yes, it's marked secret at the time of writing. It obviously deals with many subjects that either relate to projects for the fighting services, as they're termed in the document, and for the service ministries, and some of the technical problems they're seeking to solve. So yes, it's a lot to do with things for the conduct of the war, and therefore, understandably, it's secret. In fact, some passages are clearly too sensitive for Radley to give to his secretary to type up, and so we get some issues that are in his own handwriting. So that applies, for example, to the entry where Radley is inducted into the ultra secret and, you know, is told that there is something which GPO could potentially help with. That is in his handwriting rather than being typescript. After the war, many of the projects detailed in the diary do continue to have military and intelligence relevance. So the diary remains in a safe at Dollis Hill, and it never made its way into the Post Office's records department and registry system, which would be the normal process by which it would eventually make its way to the Public Record Office, as was now the National Archives. And in the 1970s, the research department moved up to Suffolk, to Martlesham near Ipswich. The diary goes with them and goes into a safe there. And it then almost becomes a sort of a little point of local interest, or if you like, a trophy for Ad Astral Park. It's something which not that many people know about there, but certainly the directors do, and they're extremely proud of it. You've also got in the middle of this privatisation happening, which slightly changes the relationship of BT to the Public Record Office, although, of course, anything that was a public record was supposed to be considered for declassification and so on. So there's no deliberate withholding, but it just gets sort of overlooked slightly. But fast forward to more recent years, and my former boss, David Hay, who was for 30 plus years the head of BT Archives, he became aware of the diary's existence, and he began periodically reminding his colleagues in the BT research department at Martlesham that the diary really should be reviewed by those qualified to say whether it still required a government security marking, whether it could now be declassified, and that it should ideally be transferred to BT Archives and made public if it was appropriate to do so. And he finally succeeded in these efforts in 2019, and he was very proud of it because this was not long before his retirement in early 2020. So the diary was reviewed, and it was decided that apart from a few remaining redactions, it could now be declassified. So it came to us towards the end of 2019, and not long before his retirement, David scanned it all in, and then COVID hit. And I therefore spent, when I was working at home, the first part of lockdown, I went through all the scans and created a high quality transcript. And finally, after a little bit more delay, we were able to publish it in the autumn of 2022. So the wartime work of the research branch is for the most part already in the public domain through other document releases. As David says, there's a lot at the National Archives. So it's not that a new understanding of the activities of the research branch has suddenly come to light. It's nuance, and it's the other side of the story, as David says. The War Diary casts new light on this and gives a sort of different detail on many of these projects.
And the scans and the transcript that you make for fascinating reading, it feels quite condensed, I suppose. It's all of those potentially vast numbers of documents at the National Archives and in the BT Archives, but through the voice of Gordon Radley, putting it sort of event after event into this diary.
That's right. It's a little detail on a lot of subjects. And because of the fact that it's written in diary form, you get that sense of all the balls that Radley is juggling, all the teams working on different projects and new things emerging during the course of war, some becoming big pieces of work which carry on right the way through, but lots of little projects as well, of staggering variety.
There's quite a range of projects. David, you've mentioned to me that these kind of divide into two, maybe three broad areas.
Yes. What is convenient for me is that Radley, although it's chronological, for each entry, he puts what's called a case number. And these case numbers run into the tens of thousands. Sort of each task that Dollis Hill is attempting gets a case number. And what it meant was I could go through the transcript and just identify the paragraphs that had case numbers on them relating to work. He never calls it Bletchley Park or GCNCS. He refers to a combined services organisation. We are doing some work for a combined services organisation, which is GCNCS. But again, he's being quite coy about who he's working for and what they're doing. And he does explain in some cases what the machines are doing. But those explanations, if you don't know the background of the codes and ciphers that are being discussed, his words wouldn't make any sense to you. Because he describes very specifically what the device does, but doesn't contextualize it with, oh, this is actually breaking code for a U-boat. He just says, we're counting numbers on an optical tape or whatever it is. But to take it sort of chronologically, the first big piece of work where Dollis Hill becomes involved is with the bomb machines. And for those of you not familiar with this, in summary, Alan Turing and Gordon Welshman develop the first bomb machine in 1939-40. And it's a device for key finding the daily settings for Enigma enciphered messages from the Germans.
And it's a large sort of wardrobe-sized machine with these round-coloured drums on the front, grouped in threes.
the early development of the bomb machines is done with British Tabulating Machines in Letchworth. They build the early devices. And that's all fine. They have a relationship with Letchworth. However, the spring of 1942, the Germans introduce Shark, which is the U-boat wireless network using a four-rotor Enigma machine, the so-called M4 Enigma. And what that does is it essentially makes the number of possibilities for the setting of the Enigma machine 26 times larger. So this would still be solvable with the bomb machines that Bletchley Park has got, but it would take more than 26 times as long. It makes the problem vastly more complicated. GCNCS actually knew that the four-rotor Enigma was coming a good 6-8 months before it actually came into service. So in the summer of 1941, they start trying to figure out how to solve the problem. And you'd think you just build a bomb machine with four drums on it instead of three and run it 26 times as fast. The problem with that is that it was already running pretty much as fast as the technology would allow, because the drums on the bomb machine have to rotate as quickly as possible, but at each position, they have to make a unique electric connection for each position on the drum, all 26 letters of the alphabet. And if you spin that drum too quickly, the electrical connections happen too quickly for the rest of the machine to work. And so they've got a challenge. How do you make a machine where the drums can go around a lot faster than they do at the moment?
Because you need, in order to tackle that fourth rotor, you need the sort of fourth drum in your group of three on the bomb, and that fourth one goes super fast.
Yes. Normal three-rotor bomb machines take about 10 minutes to do all the possibilities. But if you've got a fourth rotor, you've got 26 times as long, that's 26 times 10 minutes. So it's going to take an unreasonable amount of time. Initially, they go to the Telecommunications Research Establishment, who are more famous for radar. That was their main work. But they were involved in electronic technology. And there's an engineer there called C.E. Wynne Williams, who is already known to GCNCS. And they set him the problem of this fourth rotor, this very fast rotating wheel for the bomb machines. At the same time, they've got this problem of how do you check the electronic connections, the electrical connections, really, really quickly. And for this is where Dollis Hill become involved, because Tommy Flowers is an engineer at the post office, and he is particularly interested in the use of valve technology. These valves are essentially electronic switches. They look a bit like a long, thin light bulb, but they're essentially electronic switches, and they can switch on and off really, really quickly. So if you were to devise a machine based on valves, it could do this checking process that you need for the bomb machine absolutely as quickly as you needed. It could do it almost as quickly as you wanted. So Dollis Hill asked to build what they call a valve sensing unit. Essentially, the idea was you'd have an original bomb machine in the middle. You'd have Dollis Hill's valve sensing unit on one end, and you'd have Wynne Williams' TRE fourth rotor machine, which they call Cobra, on the other end. This would solve your four rotor bomb machine problem. Gordon Welshman approaches Gordon Radley and says, can you come on board and help us with this task? Wynne Williams has been at work for some time now. This isn't until March 1942. So Shark is already in use by the Germans. So the demand is quite urgent. This is where we start to see the other side of the hill. It's quite an interesting aside from Radley, where on the 7th of March, he says, the problem seemed to be one where the assistance of the post office should have been called in earlier. And I think he feels they're a bit late to the table here. It's like, well, why didn't you ask us last year? Because we could have potentially solved this problem. And he, at that point, brought Tommy Flowers here to Bletchley Park. They saw the existing bomb machines. They chatted to him, but they worked out what they needed to do, essentially. And they go back to London, and the valve sensing equipment that Dollis Hill are building works pretty well pretty quickly. The difficulty is that the other end of the machine, the Cobra, so-called, the fourth rotor part of it, that TRE are building, doesn't really work. The problem is you have these rotating drums in it, which spin very, very quickly. And obviously, there's an electrical contact that has to make contact with the spinning drum. And they get what they call bounce. And this is, if it goes too fast, the connection literally breaks, it bounces. It doesn't work properly. So TRE are struggling with that. And Dollis Hill are going, well, we've got this machine for you. It can be used, even on the three-rotor bomb machines, it can be used to speed up the process slightly. But that's not mainly what it's for. It's principally for solving this four-rotor problem. It happens that GCNCS has a contingency plan for this. They've also gone back to British Tabulating Machines, who built the original three-rotor bomb machines, and said to their engineer, Doc Keane, can you solve this four-rotor problem? And he's confronted with the fact that he's using electromechanical relays, these switches. And previously, the limit to how fast the machine could run was how fast these relays could open and close. So he goes, well, the logjam here is the relay. So he simply designs a relay that's something like 16 times faster than any relay that's been invented before. So he does that, and by so doing, he can then build a four-rotor bomb machine that doesn't run 26 times faster, but it certainly runs 16 times faster. So it's capable of doing the job. And it's all proven technology. It's the machine they're building already, essentially, but in a slightly different format. So GCNCS are obviously going, well, which of these projects is showing more promise? Which one is going to get us where we need to get as quickly as possible? Because they need to read U-Boat Enigma. And this is where life gets a bit political, because Gordon Welshman is having meetings with TRE. He's having meetings with Doc Keane. He's also having meetings with Gordon Radley and Tommy Flowers. And all three of them are kind of going, pick me, you know, our project is really good. Why don't you use our machine? And Gordon Welshman is in the middle of this. And he writes lengthy, lengthy memos that are in the National Archives about how this goes on. And actually, there's a short period where there's quite bad blood between GPO and BTM, because Gordon Radley and Tommy Flowers feel that they've been kind of sidelined, and they've put a huge amount of work into this, and they've delivered their part of the machine kind of on time and everything else, and they're ready to go.
The valve sensing unit.
Yeah, the valve sensing unit. And they're being held up because the people at the other end, the TRE people, haven't managed to deliver. And you get a sense of the discussion from Radley, which is interesting to see in comparison to the Gordon Welshman position. James was referring to Radley's sort of management and diplomacy, and I think he plays an important role in this. I'm looking at James now. He plays an important role in kind of managing the discussion, doesn't he? And keeping everybody talking to each other.
He does. And certainly it's known that Tommy Flowers was not the easiest person to work with. Could be extremely dogmatic. It's not only in the wartime work where he gets into difficulties through being quite abrasive and convinced that his way is the only way. That happens again with the experimental exchange that they build at Highgate Wood in the post-war period. You get the sense from the diary of Gordon Radley, together with Commander Travis, smoothing some ruffled feathers on all sides and trying to keep the relationship healthy. From Radley's point of view, let's get back to fundamentals. What can we provide that is helpful and can move things forward?
This comes to a head in particular at one point when Dollis Hill say, to finalise our device, we need to borrow a bomb machine, which we can plug it into and then test it. But of course, at this point, even the three rotor machines are in massive demand to break Enigma. So Bletchley Park are very reluctant to part with a machine. Eventually, BTM let Dollis Hill have a bomb machine, but it doesn't work. I'm oversimplifying here slightly, but you get this kind of almost playground argument of the GPO going, well, it was broken when we got it, and BTM saying, no, it's fine when we sent it to you, you've broken it. And it takes a meeting where Radley and Welshman and everybody kind of sit down and they're all agreed, are told to kiss and make up, and that everything is settled. But it's interesting because one of the mythologies of Bletchley Park is somehow that everybody collaborated and everybody got along, and that these incredible technological and mathematical achievements happened somehow seamlessly with everybody agreeing with everybody else. Actually, the reverse is true. There was a huge amount of infighting and controversy and people kind of guarding their territory or whatever, being very protective of their own intellectual IP, if you like. I mean, Dilly Knox is famous for writing memos about his code-breaking achievements being exploited by other people. But the complexities of these multi-agency engineering projects really bring that to the fore, and it shows how people like Travis and Welshman and Radley have to manage their genius but slightly unreliable subordinates to get these jobs done.
Do we get a sense of this from the diary? Is Radley openly talking about this disagreement?
I think if you read the diary, he suggests that things have been a lot calmer than I think they actually were. I mean, I had a quote from him here. On the 27th of July 1942, he's talking about the valve sensing unit. And he says, the second of four equipments referred to in the diary entries 1st of May and 5th of June, these are the valve sensing units, was shipped to the Combined Services Establishment at Bletchley Park this weekend. The first of these equipments has now been in service for a fortnight, working 24 hours per day, and has given entirely satisfactory results. It's as if, you know, everything's going swimmingly, which perhaps isn't as much as he's saying. But he's also, later on, when GCNCS basically decide to go with the BTM four-rotor machine, what they eventually call the HSK, the high-speed Keen, it's named after Doc Keen, and they buy a dozen of the Cobra machines that TRE were building with Dollis Hill, but they only ever have 12, whereas they build more than 50 of the HSK machines. So the Cobra project is kind of quietly sidelined. And Radley comments on that in July 1942, but he does it in a quite a delicate way, I think. What he actually says is, to a certain extent, it is sensed that the urge has departed from this general problem.
Very diplomatic.
It's like, we've moved on.
Yes.
Yes, nothing to see here. We're not talking about that anymore.
I think diplomacy is probably the watchword. And it's interesting, this is even in a document which Radley knows is going to have a small circulation. And I get the sense of, one, him wishing to defend the work of his department and his colleagues, but not in a stone-throwing kind of way. You don't get him trying to score points and suggest that Dollis Hill was entirely in the right on issues or casting aspersions strongly against other organisations. Whether that was happening in meetings, it's not clear, but in terms of what he wants to write down on paper, he is smoothing over. And yes, as David says, slightly playing down the sort of rivalries and difficulties that may have been going on, which you get the sense that he's one of the people helping to smooth them over.
I mentioned earlier that there's two or so large categories of these kinds of projects that the GPO are working on. And the first one that you mentioned was Enigma and bombs. What's the second one?
The second one is the German Lorenz cipher system. This is a teleprinter system. Rather than using Morse code, it uses teleprint code. It's still sent by wireless, so it can be intercepted in the UK, but it's teleprinter rather than Morse. And the cipher machine works on an entirely different basis from Enigma. It's much more complicated. And from the outset, really, it's clear that breaking this system is going to require similar technology in the same way as they did with the bomb. They're going to need to build mechanical apparatus to solve this problem, because simply doing it with a pencil and some squared paper, it's too big a problem. It would just take too long. It would be theoretically possible if you had hundreds and hundreds of people working for months and months and months, but actually doing it by machine is much, much better. The first thing they approached Dollis Hill for is a machine called Tunny, which simply, when Bill Tutt and John Tiltman have worked out how the Lorenz machine works, they need a machine that emulates the cipher machine. Mm. They haven't been able to capture one. There's very few of them anyway.
Like a Lorenz simulator.
Dollis Hill build them a Tunny machine or a series of Tunny machines which simulate the device.
But in no way look anything like the original.
No. The next problem is, how do you speed up the code breaking process? And once a code breaking process has been developed by Bill Tutt, with a little bit of help from Alan Turing, or with Max Newman, Ralph Tester. There are two sections of Bletchley called the Testery and the Newmanry. The Testery do the initial work on Lorenz and develop sort of by hand pencil and paper methods. Max Newman is brought in specifically to set up a engineering-based, technology-based solution, invent and build machines. And again, they go to the GPO and say, we need you to build these machines. There are two principal machines that are built. The code-breaking process relies on counting the frequency of letters. That's a gross simplification of the process, but basically you need to count letters on paper tapes and try different key settings of the machine against those paper tapes to see which ones work. And to do that, you need to test thousands and thousands of letters per second for it to be viable to do. And this is the kind of problem that the post office is geared up to solve. And again, Tommy Flower's name occurs because one of the solutions to this problem is to use valve technology, because these are switches that can work very, very quickly, and they will switch on and off quickly enough for you to scan letters at very high speed. But Flowers has to be managed, because his first solution is to produce a machine entirely based on valves. And he has to be told by Newman at GCNCS, but also by Radley, that valves are very expensive, valves are hard to get, you need a compromise solution. This would be the perfect answer, but it's going to take too long to make and it's too complicated. The first machine they build is a thing called Robinson, where it's all done with paper tape. And it works, but it doesn't work brilliantly. So Flowers is kind of unleashed to create Colossus, which is that's a halfway machine. It has a paper tape, but it also has a valve system. One of the tapes is replaced by electronic valves. And there are numerous entries in the diary where this process is being developed. And Radley is commenting on progress. And because the post office have to devote enormous amounts of resources to this, they have a second factory in Birmingham, which is 40 or 50 people there are taken over to build these things. And they have to build different bits of it in different places. So it's a huge investment of resources. But also, again, Radley has to manage Flowers' aspirations and flights of fancy in some cases. The upshot of this process is, and this is a famous event in Bletchley Park history, the first Colossus machine was delivered in February 1944. We've known for a long time Tommy Flowers' diary entry, where he writes, I think, Colossus delivered today, car broke down on the way home, which is a wonderful diary entry. We have a more fulsome diary entry from Gordon Radley in the Dollis Hill diary.
The equipment of the type described in the diary entry of the 2nd of October last and which was taken to Bletchley in the latter part of January, was ready for operation on February the 5th. This machine has been christened Colossus, but it is capable of working at approximately 15 times the speed of the two tape machines, besides having greater flexibility and providing additional facilities.
Radley also gives us an impression of just how much work the post office is having to do, and he gives some interesting statistics of how much effort they've applied to the Colossus problem.
The research branch has undertaken to supply a second one of these machines to be in operation by June the 1st, a third by July the 1st, and a fourth in August. In order to do this, it has been necessary to reinforce the research group concerned by some 30 workmen accustomed to exchange maintenance or construction. S Branch has given very considerable assistance with regard to obtaining required components, which includes such items as 20,000 resistors and over 5,000 valves. The maximum possible assistance in all this work is being obtained from the factories department. The factories are relieving the Dollis Hill workshops largely of such work as the making and drilling of panels. Because of its nature, however, very much of the later work must be done in the laboratories at Dollis Hill, where it will necessitate the expenditure of about 25,000 man-hours on construction and 15,000 on testing.
One of the insights that Radley gives us here is a second voice on the Colossus project, apart from Tommy Flowers, because Tommy Flowers lived to a ripe old age and recounted his version of events on a number of occasions. And he tends to portray the process as him as a kind of ploughing a lone furrow and doing it on his own initiative.
I mean, he was very significant.
He was very significant. I mean, he did the engineering design. He was a very clever guy. But he seems to suggest that he did it rather in spite of the management rather than with the help of the management. It's not Tommy Flowers' fault necessarily, but this mythology has grown of him being a sort of, I don't know, not quite a rebel, but a sort of having to fight to get Colossus built on his own initiative. What the diary shows us and what some of the paperwork in the National Archives shows us is actually that Max Newman, Edward Travis, Gordon Radley were all massively behind this project. There was no suggestion that it wasn't going to get done. It's much more official than the Flowers legend leads you to believe. And also, it involved a lot more people. Again, you get one name attached to things and you think of one bloke in a shed working away. Clearly, Radley drew in huge amounts of post office resource to apply to this project. And they didn't just build the one. Obviously, by the end of the war, they built 10 of these things. So the team carries on working, and each machine is an enormous endeavour in its own right. Famously, the second Colossus machine is delivered on 1st of June 1944, just before D-Day. It's slightly coincidental that it's just before D-Day. It doesn't matter particularly for the invasion whether or not Colossus 2 had arrived at that point. It's not going to do anything between the 1st of June and the 6th of June that matters, really. One of the few occasions where Gordon Radley mentions people by name in the diary, he describes a number of people who were involved in the Colossus project and thanks them specifically. Ironically, Flowers isn't one of the names on the list.
The completion of Colossus 2 on time has been a particularly fine effort on the part of the team concerned, and has only been possible because of their unremitting application to the job. Very high praise is due to the executive and assistant engineers, Dr. Coombs, and Messrs. Broadhurst, Saville, Chandler, and Tissington, who have wrestled with difficult technical problems far into and through the night, without thinking of going home. They have, by their example, given much encouragement and inspiration to the more junior staff.
It's worth remembering that the context for this post-war is that Tommy Flowers, for a long time, didn't get public recognition for his contribution. He did eventually, obviously, in a big way, but that took a very long time in coming. And he didn't get really any significant financial compensation for his achievements. And that probably defines some of what he said after the war. He felt, rightly or wrongly, a little bit overlooked, and that probably defines some of his statements post-war. And that's with some justification.
Having said that, it's too late for Tommy Flowers because he passed away, but he is now a well-known figure. And as I said at the beginning, it's interesting that Doc Keane, the engineer in the bomb project, has been sort of forgotten. But the engineer for the Colossus project is well known, whereas the cryptographer for the Colossus project, Bill Tutt, has kind of been forgotten. One of the final projects in the war diary, which only gets a relatively small entry, is one that particularly intrigues me because I'm interested in Italian code breaking as well. And we've talked in the past about the Hagelin cipher machine.
So this is neither Enigma nor Lorenz.
It's a third system that was used by the Italians. And we know that again, an analog machine that functioned like a haggling machine, was built for Bletchley Park. But we don't know what it looked like. We have testimony from veterans who operated it, who give a loose description of it. And we know it was in this building in Block A, but we know nothing else about it. So it's rather tantalizing that Radley talks about, in case number 11824, a ciphering machine that he doesn't name. And the description he gives would potentially fit Nightingale, which is this analog machine that was built for haggling ciphers. But I'm not sure. It's another little snippet in my ongoing quest to find out about Nightingale. He may be talking about something completely different. We don't know.
Well, let's hear what he had to say about Nightingale, potentially.
A ciphering machine in use is mechanical in construction and manual in operation. The manual operating is slow and laborious. An electromechanical equivalent has been built. It comprises contact operating press buttons arranged typewriter keyboard fashion, a jack field for changing the cipher key, 400 relays for ciphering operations, and a magnet-operated teleprinter for printing. It works at some 10 times the speed of the original, and with far less fatigue to the operator. The machine was demonstrated at Dollis Hill yesterday, and will be shipped to Bletchley next week.
Obviously, we've heard that the GPO was involved in a number of projects with Bletchley Park, but James, there were plenty outside that Bletchley Park relationship that Dollis Hill was working on in World War II, weren't there?
Absolutely. Dollis Hill is, at this point, really one of the only areas of expertise on sort of electrical matters within government, but also on various allied technologies. And so it gets called in to do all manner of things. The biggest thing that goes throughout the war in a number of different guises is around covert microphones. As early as 5th of September 1939, Dollis Hill gets called in to install some hidden microphones at the Tower of London, which was at that point in the war is being used to house high-ranking prisoners of war. And that's just the start of a huge piece of work that carries on throughout the war, which is for a branch of military intelligence, which was somewhat euphemistically known as the Combined Services Detailed Interrogation Centre. For a while, it's MI9, and then it becomes, after a renumbering, it becomes MI19. And their task was the covert recording of POWs talking unguardedly amongst themselves. It was a very successful enterprise, and that's been termed by some as the greatest intelligence operation of World War II. So Dollis Hill technicians installed microphones that they generally tended to be hidden in light fittings, but they could also be outside in plant pots and statuary and so on. The prisoner of war camps in question were mostly converted stately homes around London. So you get Trent Park, which is up in Cockfosters, Beaconsfield, Wilton Park, and Latimer House, which is out on northwest of London, on the far end of the Metropolitan Line. And later on in the war, when the war moves into North Africa and into the Middle East and then into France, there are also similar camps set up in the same way there. They end up processing a huge amount of intelligence because it's prisoners of war are basically cycled through these camps. Anyone who might have a bit of information, they go through these camps and are left alone in twos and threes, and then the microphones record what's going on. The difficulty, actually, a lot of it was recording, because at this point, magnetic audio recording tape has been invented, but it's a German invention, so the Allies haven't got it. So Dollis Hill has to work with one of the only firms doing this kind of recording, which is onto vinyl records, and this chap with a small firm who's been working for the BBC primarily to help them make recordings. They have to help him scale up his operations and improve them so that recordings can be made, because the demand is insatiable from the Combined Services Detailed Interrogation Centre, but also from MI5 and other parts of government. Dollis Hill was doing this kind of stuff for sort of eavesdropping on suspected Nazi sympathisers and fifth columnists, for the interrogation of captured German spies at Latchmere House. There's a wonderful extract of the diary where Radley refers to a special sort of short notice project to deal with a flying visitor from Scotland. And from the dates, this is clearly Rudolf Hess, when he has made his abortive attempt to sue for a negotiated peace by flying on his own into Scotland. They have to, at short notice, make an installation at Mitchett Place in Surrey, where Hess was being detained.
19th of May 1941. Work for the War Office. On Friday the 16th of May, a request was received from the War Group to inspect a large private house, about 40 miles from London, which was being prepared for the reception of a distinguished guest who had paid a flying visit to Scotland. If possible, four rooms, a bedroom and a private sitting room upstairs, and a dining room and a very large sitting room downstairs, were to be fitted with concealed microphones. The house was visited on Friday afternoon, and it was found that the work had to be carried out between 2:30 p.m. on Saturday and 2:30 p.m. on Monday, during which time the house would be free of workmen, etc. A request of this kind had been anticipated, and a certain amount of equipment had already been collected. This was taken down on Saturday, and work was commenced at 2:30 p.m. By using ceiling fittings upstairs, and a new design of floor fitting upstairs, the number of floors which had to be disturbed was reduced, but was still considerable owing to the size of the house. Installation was, however, completed just after midnight on Sunday, and the house was handed over at 9 a.m. on Monday morning.
The GPO also worked on the other side of this sort of project, detecting this kind of equipment too, didn't they?
That's right. They knew they were doing it, and so they had to be suspicious. The other side was as well. One of the things that's funny is that this is before terms like bugs and bugging and wiretaps existed. So it's referred to quite a lot as eavesdropping. Early in the war, just before Dunkirk, in fact, and just after Churchill has taken office as Prime Minister, obviously some presumably unreliable intelligence comes that there are bugs in 10 Downing Street. And so Dollis Hill is asked to come up with a way of sweeping for them. So they go into the cabinet room at number 10 and, using improvised tools, look for hidden wiring, hidden microphones. They come up with nothing, but they do modify the telephone that sits there permanently to ensure that there's no way that anybody could be listening through the telephone handset that's sitting there in the cabinet room. Later on in the war, they end up doing the same thing at the British Embassy in Moscow, because obviously by this stage already there are concerns that our allies and Soviet Union could be listening in. And so the same thing is done at the accommodation at the Tehran conference, because in both cases, yes, they're worried, with good reason, that the Soviets might have planted bugs in those facilities.
And as a slight change of topic, can you give us some examples of non-intelligence related work that is picked up in Gordon Radley's diary?
Yeah, and there is a lot of it. They are doing work for Fighter Command. Particularly, there's something called the auto teller for Fighter Command, which is effectively, it was that you've got the collation of information coming in at high speed, plots at radar stations and so on, and they're being sent through to Fighter Command via teleprinter. And they devised this system called the autoteller, which effectively converts that into a spoken announcement, you know, raiders at such and such a height, at such and such a position. And that's working along similar lines to the speaking clock that they'd devised in the 1930s. Pre-existing recordings being queued up based on the information that's fed into it. You've also got things like Dollis Hill's looking after the technical aspects of the microgram service, by which, particularly in distant theatres of war, you've got a lot of military documentation flowing backwards and forwards, stuff which didn't merit being transmitted by radio, but which did need to get either forward to the front or back from the front. And so the military is making increasing use of photographic reproduction, so what we'd think of these days as microfilm. Dollis Hill is involved in the technical aspects of that. That ends up then going again in the direction of MI5, who are seeking to better understand how texts could be photographed and dramatically reduced in size in order to send hidden messages. In another case where the terminology that we know it by now doesn't quite exist, they're not referring to it yet as microdots. But that's effectively what they're looking into.
Wow.
They also do things around looking at bomb disposal, you know, sort of devices to detect whether unexploded bombs might be duds or were still real. And there's all sorts of things around looking at ways to sabotage telephone exchanges in the event of invasion. A long piece of work working with the army on ways of making the radios in tanks easier for the drivers and tank commanders to listen to for prolonged periods. You know, a tank is obviously an extremely noisy environment, and so the volume had to be up extremely loud for the radios, that the radio sets that they had there. And it's ways to try and make that less tiring, effectively, for those doing it. Another one is, we've mentioned D-Day, but in the run-up to D-Day, one of the famous projects, of course, is Pluto, the pipeline under the ocean, by which petrol could be supplied by pipeline to Normandy until ports were open and tankers could go through. And the post office, of course, had expertise in this kind of thing from cable laying, from laying transatlantic and transoceanic telegraph and telephone cables. So they're involved in the early stages of Pluto, working on the fabrication of lead cables, which could be spooled and then loaded across to France. And that's just a sample. There are a huge variety of things.
Just to add to that, one of the things that I came across in my D-Day research, which I thought was really interesting, is Pluto is very well known and the supply of petrol. But the other thing that needs to cross the channel in both directions is data. The GPO are involved in laying a series of telegraph cables. And this is relevant to Bletchley Park because part of the way Ultra is delivered becomes by teleprint. And if you imagine, once the Normandy invasion is in progress, the amount of just military information that needs to go back and forth, you can't do it on wireless, there's too much of it. I think the post office actually lose a ship, don't they? One of the cable laying ships is sunk
by
the Germans.
Yes. I'm trying to remember if it's the Alert. I think it is the Alert that's lost.
But when we talk about intelligence, we're also talking about the information war and about data, and they play a big role in that as well.
I should say that that extends beyond just France, but one of the big activities that Dolisil is involved in throughout the war, and presumably it sits with the research branch rather than just more broadly, the engineering department, is some specialist aspects to it. But they are doing both cable and radio links throughout the UK, especially in the Scottish Islands. It's not alluded to, again, in the case of the diary, Radley doesn't usually get into why these things are being done. So you'd have to cross-reference with other materials to work out. But I'm assuming it's to do with the Battle of the Atlantic. It's connecting up Royal Naval bases, Fleet Air Arm bases, and so on, to enable the information side of the logistics of the Battle of the Atlantic.
I think our listeners are going to find this so interesting. This diary is such a valuable resource, and I'm sure it's something that BT Group Archives are rightly proud of as well. It's kind of a monument, I guess, both to Gordon Radley and to the work of the GPO. What would you say, James, is the legacy of Gordon Radley and other people involved in these projects like Tommy Flowers? And why is this so important to BT Group?
Well, the post office and then BT have continued to do research. It's obviously changed the nature of what it is. But as David said earlier on, Dolisil decamped to Suffolk, to Martlesham in the 1970s, and it's still there. And it continues to be BT's main campus for research and innovation. The focus as a private company, it's less these days on warfare, but it's things like the Internet of Things, virtual reality, augmented reality, AI, and practical things around the workings of 5G and how to send data faster down BT's networks. Ad Astral's also home to something called the Tommy Flowers Network, which is a project which aims to bring together the British ICT industry together with British universities, postgraduate researchers in related fields to build understanding on the biggest challenges that the UK telecommunications sector is facing. There is actually, in the main building at Ad Astral Park, there is a bust of Tommy Flowers there. And similarly, BT has awards for its technology staff each year. And one of them is the Gordon Radley Award, which is given for the best published paper that year by a member of BT staff. And of course, in terms of the diary itself, it was a big deal for us in the archives to be able to push it out there. And so we went to town a little bit on our pages on the BT website. And there's a little mini site on the archives section of the BT website with the diary in two forms, the original scans and then the nice, easy to search transcription and some nice audio-visual clips of some of the interesting passages from the diary. Because it rightly is celebrating a key part in our history.
And it's an example of the kind of documents that are still coming to light, I suppose, which share some sort of insight into the more secret, perhaps less understood areas of World War II history. It's such a valuable resource. And the fact that you said it's in Gordon Radley's own hand in places as well has that really personal connection. I suppose it connects us to those secret, really significant activities that fascinate us, fascinate our listeners. We really recommend to the listeners, take a look at the diary yourself. Find your favourite search engine, pop in Dollis Hill War Diary. It will absolutely be the top thing that you find there. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode, James. It's been absolutely wonderful hearing what you have to say about Gordon Radley and about the diary. And I think it's best that we leave the last word to Gordon Radley himself. So let's hear his words praising his team and summing up his staff's contributions to victory in World War II.
31st of May, 1945. It will perhaps be appropriate to conclude this diary by the quotation of part of an instruction circulated yesterday to all members of the research branch staff in the laboratories, workshop, and offices. During the past 5.5 years, the work of most of you has had very different objectives from those of our pre-war research investigations. Those objectives have, in some cases, been known to you. In others, they have been unknown or only partially known. Owing to the secrecy which has had to surround many of the more important projects with which we have been concerned, I alone have had the satisfaction of knowing fully the extent to which our work has contributed to the war effort. I wish that I could share my knowledge with every member of the staff, for the record is one of which we could all be justly proud. But the defence of the country in the event of future war entirely prohibits publicity. It may be sufficient to say that, not only have we assisted the research and development branches of the three fighting services, but much of our work has been even more immediately concerned with military operations. Rapid accomplishment of some of this work was stated by the War Cabinet to be of overriding importance, but, faced with tasks which involved not only research but production programmes which were big undertakings, you carried them through to the full satisfaction of our customers. It is unlikely that the war against Japan will make so many direct demands on the branch. On the other hand, it is no time for relaxation of effort, for we have had during the past 5 years to neglect much of our normal work, have therefore much leeway to make up. Other branches of the Engineer-in-Chief's office are looking to us for the speedy solution of problems which are of considerable importance to the reconstruction and post-war development of the post office system.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.